This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tortoise. Hello, it's Giles Whittell. I'm Tortoise's deputy editor. It's the week ending Friday the 5th of April, and this episode of the News Meeting is going to sound a little different, isn't it, Kat Neelan?
Yes, it is. So yesterday afternoon, you, me, Tortoise's climate editor Jeevan Varsagar and news editor Jess Winch recorded a whole episode together.
And then on Thursday evening, which is last night, there was a big development in the story that you pitched. So now a lot of that pitch is out the window, and that's how news goes. So what we thought we'd do is haul you back in to do an updated version of your story, and that's what we're going to do now. Kat and I will discuss her pitch, her updated pitch, and then you'll hear Jess Winch and Jeevan's pitches from the original recording. Kat, now listen, this is a great opportunity to claw your way back, because I did rank your story last yesterday. Perhaps, no promises.
Outrageously.
The new developments will change that. So take it from the top.
So the story unfolded over the course of a few days. Originally, as it was reported, there were six people, a combination of MPs, parliamentary staffers and journalists who had been approached by someone purporting to call themselves Abby or Charlie. The attack appears to have taken place over several months and continued right up until March. The kind of thing that was particularly striking for us was that the sender or senders of the messages seemed to have a really extensive knowledge of both their targets and of Westminster itself. So there were references made to individuals' work on the Mid-Bedfordshire by-election. There was a reference to the Nandy campaign, which was Lisa Nandy's leadership campaign from a few years back. One staffer, I believe, was sent a message referring to the breakdown of their relationship, which again is a level of detail that I think particularly struck me because this person is not someone in the public eye. How would someone get that level of detail? And then other kind of references to things like the sports, which is a nickname for one of Parliament's bars. All of this was intriguing and alarming because it sort of posed the question, how did this person get this information? Who are they? And, you know, to what extent have they managed to infiltrate Parliament? And then last night, The Times broke an extraordinary component of this story, identifying the fact that the senior MP, William Ragg, who he's never been a minister, but he chairs one of Parliament's committees and he sits on the 1922 executive, which means that he has a certain level of power and influence within Parliament. He actually had confessed to being the person that had given out the numbers of the people who had been targeted. And it transpires that he had met a man on Grindr, which is the gay dating app, and then it appears that he was being blackmailed after he had sent intimate pictures of himself. And I just want to take a second to read out the quote that William Ragg gave to the Times, because I think it, to me, it kind of underlines why I feel like at the minute people are seeing him within the party as a victim of blackmail. So he said, he told the Times, "They had compromising things on me. They wouldn't leave me alone. They would ask for people. I gave them some numbers, not all of them. I told him to stop. He's manipulated me, and now I've hurt other people." And then he goes on, "I've hurt people by being weak. I was scared. I'm mortified. I'm so sorry that my weakness has caused other people hurt." There are still question marks as to who this person was. It doesn't appear as though William Ragg ever actually met him. And so we still don't really know the true identity of this individual. There is some speculation, as there was when the original Politico story broke, that it could be a hostile state actor. There is some suggestion that it seems to be more likely to be Russian than Chinese, based on the sort of honey trap modus operandi. But it is unclear exactly who that is. And there are investigations ongoing now, both a police investigation by Leicestershire Police, which is not near Ragg's constituency, and a parliamentary inquiry. The government minister that was speaking about it this morning was saying that they didn't expect William Ragg to lose the whip, to be suspended from the party. And, you know, having had a quick sort of ask around from my sources, that seems to be the case for now. But quite what where it leaves William Ragg himself is another issue. He was standing down at the next general election anyway. But clearly he is in a difficult situation on a personal and professional basis.
Jack, what about the party? This is presumably a head in hands moment for number 10.
I think it is prompting a sort of more general moment of soul searching across Parliament, because, I mean, the nub of what I was pitching yesterday still stands, in that there are not there is not routine training offered to people when they enter Parliament, you know, including staffers and MPs, and we've had some very young MPs and young staffers come in who are sort of naive to the sort of attacks that might be happening. Now, William Ragg is in his 30s. He's not young, and he's not sort of, you know, green and naive in that respect. And I think this kind of shows that actually, you know, you can be any age and be sort of gulled into things that, you know, can leave you very...
Wait a second. I realise I'm old enough to be his dad, and I'm going to sound like that, but he's a senior MP, as you say. What the heck was he doing on Grindr, or any dating app for that matter?
Well, I mean, MPs have a private life, you know? I mean...
Yeah, but they're public people. Anyway, carry on. Sorry, that's my grandpa moment, but...
I mean, I don't think there's any distinction between being on Grindr or being on Hinge or any of the other dating apps out there.
No, I entirely agree. But I just want to pick up on another point that you just made, which was that they don't have training. The idea that you need training. I mean, who are these people coming into Parliament? Implicitly begging to be treated as children before they govern the country. It seems to be absolutely staggering. So you can see, by the way, that you have provoked in me a certain greater level of interest in this story than I evinced at first blush. You've done a lot of reporting on these kinds of issues, the sort of foibles, peccadilloes of individual parliamentarians, the vulnerability of the institution because of those things. In your view, is Westminster a magnet for people who are unusual in their sexual proclivities, their eagerness to experiment and adventure in their private lives. There's a serious question, which, you know, we have to ask, for example, about the Catholic Church, as over the decades, sexual scandals unfold there. You have to ask yourself, is the institution a magnet for a particular kind of person? So the same question applies to Westminster.
I will respond with what one MP said to me this morning when I was talking to him about whether he thought William Ragg might lose the whip. And he said, he's not a sex pest and he shouldn't be treated as such. And I think that's probably a very fair characterising of the situation. So I think you do need to sort of differentiate what, you know, kind of some of the stories that we have done in the past around sort of more predatory behaviour and what happens here, which it seems to be foolish and very unfortunate. But I think that in this case, William Ragg does appear to have been the victim of blackmail. That has unfortunately then led to him perhaps compromising some of his colleagues. But it's not in the same category as some of the behaviour that we have touched on before.
Okay. How's this going to play out in the weekend papers? As a last question, surely it's going to be seen as a party question.
It undoubtedly will be. And I have seen people sort of wrapping it up into that kind of Tory sleaze, get them out narrative. I think it will depend on your starting point. If your starting point is enough of these Tories, let's get them out, then this will reinforce that. But to my mind, as I say, it is more about security than sleaze.
Okay. Thank you. Very considered, much more considered and grown-up response to the story than my own. Thank you, Kat. We're now going to cut seamlessly to Jess and Jeevan's pitches from yesterday.
Jess, tell us a bit more about your story.
This is a story about what has been happening in Israel and Gaza this week, and it has felt like a particularly busy week where a lot has happened all at once. So you've had the death of 7 foreign aid workers in Gaza when an Israeli drone fired missiles at their convoy, and the resulting outrage around the world. You've had a presumed Israeli strike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Benny Gantz, a member of Israel's war cabinet, has been calling for early elections. And on Thursday, around 600 members of the British legal profession, including three former Supreme Court justices, have signed a letter calling for the UK to halt arms sales to Israel, just to name a few. But as we record this on Thursday, I thought one way to try and look ahead would be to see what impact the outrage at particularly the attack on the aid convoy might mean for the looming, and it has been looming for a while, planned Israeli assault on the city of Rafah in southern Gaza.
So are you suggesting that it might stay their hand?
Well, interestingly, there was a readout from a call yesterday between Lloyd Austin, America's defense secretary, and his counterpart in Israel. And he specifically linked the strike on the World Central Kitchen aid workers to the risk of an Israeli operation in Rafah. He said the death showed the risk of doing that. Rafah is a city where around 1.5 million Palestinians are currently sheltering. I think the readout from that call and that link between the two is interesting because it highlights the concern that the US and I'm sure other allies of Israel have over how Israel is conducting this war and what an offensive in Rafah would mean for the civilians sheltering there. There was also, interestingly, there was a report by NBC this week where there was a meeting in Washington between US and Israeli officials, which included some really interesting details, which showed that Israel doesn't really have a plan for what it does with the civilians currently sheltering in Rafah. They proposed moving around 1.4, 1.5 million north of the city, but apparently it didn't really have proposals for how to manage sanitation, how to ensure food supplies, how they would even procure the necessary supply of tents. And I think a question going into the weekend is whether the events this week may stay their hand, may cause them to change course.
Well, let's just come back to the strike on the convoy. Am I right that what we're looking at here is two pretty much incompatible explanations for what happened. And if you'll forgive the shorthand, one is the fog of war, and the other is the deliberate abuse of the fog of war by one party in this war. Is that fair?
So the head of the World Central Kitchen gave an interview to Reuters where he was pretty explicit that the Israeli attack had targeted the convoy, quote, systematically, car by car. It looks as though this was a drone carrying spike missiles that targeted all three vehicles that were travelling in the WCK convoy. Jose Andres, who is the founder, was pretty clear that he did not consider this a bad luck situation where, oops, they've dropped the bomb in the wrong place, as he described it. He considered it a very deliberate action. And Israel has admitted that they did it, but they have said that it shouldn't have happened, although Netanyahu did add that these things happen in war.
But is it explicable, do you think, in terms of a breakdown in chain of command as between military commanders, the defense ministry in Israel proper, and commanders on the ground? This was a drone attack, so there are multiple links in the chain. You've probably got someone raising the alarm about this convoy, a process of checking and count. We hope. Are we cleared to fire? And a mistake occurred. Is it explicable in terms of a mistake in that chain?
It's one explanation. I've seen various analysts suggesting that there has been a breakdown between what senior commanders in Israel are saying and how that is being interpreted by commanders on the ground in Gaza, namely that there is a much more careless attitude when you're actually on the ground.
And possibly a deliberately careless attitude, or if the head of World Central Kitchen is to be believed, a systematically careless attitude.
The suggestion is that this is more of a, I think, a policy of deliberate carelessness.
Right. Jeevan and Kat, we'll come on to your views on this in just a second. I just want to come back to one of the other points that you mentioned in what, as you say, has been an incredibly intense week in the region. And that is this letter signed by 600 UK lawyers calling for the UK government to halt arms exports to Israel. Hashi Mohammed, who's a barrister and contributing editor at Tortoise, is one of the signatories of that letter, and he sent us a voice note explaining why he'd signed it.
I signed this letter because I think we are way past the point of Israel having completely and utterly disregarded international humanitarian law. And this is because we have seen the way that the indiscriminate killings of civilians and aid workers before the latest seven foreign aid workers were killed shows that the rules of engagement and the way in which the country is currently functioning demonstrate that they have absolutely zero regard, either on a systematic basis or at an operational level. And we're in good company. There are many retired judges, including judges in the Supreme Court, who have all come to the judgment that we have reached that point, that now the United Kingdom selling arms or arms systems would amount to us potentially breaching international humanitarian law. I understand that the Foreign Office has received advice to that effect that is yet to be released. And it's obvious what's happening now. And it's also obvious that we are seeing a plausible genocide taking place. We are unable to verify a great deal in person. Many aid agencies are talking about us all being witness to a famine that's about to break out. I'm only one of 600 preeminent lawyers, judges, academics who are in the legal profession who have all contributed to this. It's the least I could do from a legal standpoint to put that name on that paper, on that letter to the Prime Minister to say, we are not complicit and you need to do something about it.
Thank you, Hashi. Kat, what do you think?
I mean, in terms of the sort of Westminster context, it has had a significant effect. We spoke before the last time we sort of, or the last time I think that I was on the news meeting talking about the conflict, in terms of my sense that there had been a tipping point within Westminster, and that there was a sort of, to me, it felt like an increased number of MPs across the political spectrum who were calling for a ceasefire. Last week, there was a letter written or signed, sorry, by well over 100 MPs, including senior Conservative, Labour and SNP MPs and Lib Dems, talking about their concerns about famine and arguing for the immediate restoration of UNRWA. On the back of the attack on the convoy in which three Brits were killed, you know, that has really brought things home to the British media and British politicians. And so you have seen a kind of recalibration, and now the government is under significant pressure to suspend arms sales to Israel, or to effectively to block companies from selling into Israel. There is precedent for this. It was done under Tony Blair. It was done under Margaret Thatcher. It was almost done when David Cameron, who is now the Foreign Secretary, was Prime Minister during the coalition years. Vince Cable, who was Business Secretary at the time, appears to have won a battle in which the Conservatives were quite reluctant to concede that weapon sales would be prohibited, but they agreed during a ceasefire. Now, as it turns out, that ceasefire actually held, and there was no kind of significant resumption of hostilities that kind of put that to the test. But it shows that there is a kind of recent precedent for banning the sale of weapons. But in terms of the pure and simple kind of positioning on things, you are now seeing Labour, who have been very closely mapping themselves to the government, calling for, firstly, the legal advice to be published that the government appears to have received. Last week, a recording emerged in which Alicia Kearns, who is the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, appeared to suggest that the government had received legal advice suggesting that Israel had broken international humanitarian law. So there is pressure on the government to release that, and there is also pressure on the government to suspend arms sales. And David Cameron is seemingly not responding to questions. He has told journalists that he is not answering any questions on this matter, which is creating a bit of a vacuum, but to me also suggests that they are working out what they are going to do next. And it wouldn't surprise me if there is a change.
Jeevan just mentioned the death of the seven aid workers, the call for early elections, the strike on Iran's embassy in Damascus, this letter that we've been discussing, calling for a suspension of arms exports to Israel. Do you agree it's been a busy week? And which of those elements strikes you as the most important?
Charles, I think the first thing to say is that it's obviously incredibly distressing what's happening in Gaza at the moment, both the situation for all the people who live there, but also what looks like the deliberate targeting of people who went to help in a war zone. I guess I'd make one slightly cynical observation about this, which is that it is striking that it took the deaths of some Westerners to push this story up the agenda for the press and for politicians. And I actually think the British public is in a different place on this. I think, you know, the public, we've seen them be marching in their thousands over Gaza for some time now. They're capable of much broader sympathy, I think, than some newspapers and some MPs are. In terms of Jess's story, I think my question about the story, you've rightly identified a number of different elements here. My question about the story is, which of those elements is the one that, in her view, is most important, and which is the one that we should report out in more detail? For me, I think the bombing of the embassy is an extraordinary thing. I'd certainly like to know more about that. But I think the deaths of the aid workers is the most compelling story this week. And I'd like to understand more about the chain of command, more about what led to what led to them apparently being targeted, if that was the case.
Jess, you had your finger up.
Yes, I wanted to make the same point as Jeevan, which is that this is by no means the first case of humanitarian workers in Gaza being killed. Around 196 have died in Gaza since the start of the offensive, according to UN figures. And I've seen reported from by the UN humanitarian coordinator for the area that figure is nearly three times the death toll recorded in any single conflict in a year, which just puts this into perspective. And as Jeevan says, it should not have taken the deaths of seven workers from an international organization to have provoked this reaction. I know Jeevan was asking what I felt. I suppose I fudged at the beginning because I listed all these things that had happened, when actually what I was trying to then do is focus on the aid convoy, but more from the perspective of what that means for Rafah, as a way of trying to look ahead and trying to, at the end of a week, pitch a story that I think could take us into next week.
Okay. Well, we'll obviously have to wait and see what the IDF chooses or doesn't choose to do in Rafah. There is no easy solution, not least because the 1.4 million displaced Palestinians there have nowhere to go, and Egypt doesn't appear to be an option. For a whole host of reasons, it'll be a subject for another discussion. Thanks, Jess. Let's take a break, and we'll hear what Jeevan thinks should lead the news.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. The risks posed by AI range from bias in decision-making to misinformation and the misuse of personal information, all at an unprecedented scale. Nearly a quarter of UK businesses understand that the regulatory landscape is changing fast, and nearly half are tracking new regulatory guidance to be responsive to emerging best practice. The EY Responsible AI Service helps organisations innovate safely, providing confidence that AI and generative AI technologies are developed and managed ethically, transparently, and sustainably, and that potential regulatory and reputational risks are identified and mitigated. Discover how you can create a better working world with AI by going to ey.ai.
Jeevan, tell us about your story.
So, Giles, the story that I'm pitching is based on an interview in the German newspaper Bild with Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi. Now, what Botswana's president has said is he's threatened to send 20,000 of his country's elephants to Germany. And this is in response to the German Environment Agency saying there should be stricter limits on the import of hunting trophies. Now, obviously, this is a rhetorical flourish. You aren't going to see elephants wandering through the centre of Berlin anytime soon. At least I doubt that very much. So my question here is, why is he saying this? What's going on? A bit of context first, which is that Botswana has the world's largest elephant population. 130,000 of these magnificent creatures, just imagine them swaying across the African plain. It's allowed trophy hunting since 2019, and this costs about $48,000 a pop. And elephants eat a
lot. But let's be clear, that's an earner for Botswana.
Absolutely. Yep. So Botswana's point here is that the money from trophy hunting helps them to support conservation. And they also said that elephant numbers have to be managed. Now, I think what's interesting about the story is this. I think, firstly, Botswana has a point. So countries in Europe have been chopping down their forests. So they've been digging up coal and burning it. They've eradicated the wolf and the bear and the lynx all along the way. And we've all got rich by doing that. And now Europe is saying to Africa, oh, no, you preserve the lion. Oh, and please don't burn any fossil fuels. Please stay poor. We like it that way. So the reason I'm pitching this, the why of the story, is about whether we can protect nature, even if we can't assign a financial value to it. But what I think, what I want to talk about is the way that I'd like to do the story. So I think there are two parts to this. Firstly, there's a counterfactual to Botswana. Now, that is Kenya, which bans hunting and has banned hunting for several decades. And they've also burned ivory as a statement to poachers that a tusk look better on an elephant. There's no value to attach to the tusk when it's severed from the elephant. So my question is I think that part of this is a data investigation. Who does better at protecting elephants? A country that permits hunting or a country that doesn't? And I think, you know, you have that ready-made comparison there. But I think the second part of this is really critical, and this is what I'm pitching as an element of gonzo journalism. Now, to me, killing an elephant would be like drowning a puppy, but I eat baby sheep, I wear leather shoes, I wear a leather belt, so maybe I'm a hypocrite on this. What I'm proposing is the tortoise buys a hunting license for me, and then I go and shoot an elephant. And this leads us into our reporting of the story. So that's my pitch.
Jeevan, it was only in the last few seconds that I realised where you were going with that. It would be very, very well read. And having looked into this overnight, I'm more persuaded than I have been by the argument that trophy hunting is viable and an important source of finance for some places. The key point here is that Botswana has done so well with its conservation, isn't it? And I'm not sure that your comparison with Kenya is all that valid. Kenya's population of elephants is much lower than Botswana's. Its human population is much higher.
Well, I think that's where the data investigation comes in. You're right that Kenya has a much smaller population of elephants. Kenya's elephant population is going up. And as you say, there are many more people living in Kenya. So you'd have to kind of take some of these factors into account and say which of these approaches is better. And you might end up, you know, after doing a bit of digging into this, saying actually trophy hunting is the way forward.
Jess, what do you make of this?
I think the idea of a data investigation.
Jess,
trying
I want to know what's funny about me killing an elephant.
It's not funny at all, Jeevan. I can tell you now, you're not going.
Those expenses aren't going to wash. Okay.
Well, expenses among other concerns. Yeah, no, but so that I would just say no to. I don't think that's the way to. And I think if you're reaching to that extent, that undermines the story.
Rachel.
But I like this story because I think kudos to Botswana for getting us all talking about it and getting us all talking about conservation, what's effective, what's not, what's sustainable, what's not, even if you're not going to see 20,000 elephants hot-footing it off to Berlin.
The moral core of this story is your point, Jeevan, about the rich world asking the less rich world to preserve its nature for our gratification without assigning a financial value to it. And if you're not going to do it by selling hunting licenses, well, there are alternatives, aren't there? It costs a heck of a lot to go and see living gorillas in Rwanda, for example.
Absolutely. And tourism is one of the big alternatives. I mean, one of the other things that has been done is paying poorer countries to keep their forests. So Norway did this with Guyana a few years ago, providing aid for Guyana not to chop down its trees. What happened next was that Guyana discovered oil, and the money that it got from Norway for preserving its trees is an absolute drop in the ocean compared to the money that it's getting for extracting its crude.
Kat, what do you make of Botswana's elephant surplus?
Well, Jeevan's novel pitch has certainly got my attention, but I would tend to agree with Jess that I'm not sure it's appropriate. What do you gain from shooting an elephant that you wouldn't gain from dispassionate observing of the, as you say, compare and contrast?
I gain tusks above my mantelpiece.
All right.
Okay, so as I said yesterday, my original ranking was Gaza first, Jeevan's elephant second, and Kat, your story came last. Having heard your updated pitch, my verdict is as follows. I make no apology for the fact that I still think the Botswana elephant story is not just comical and cuddly in a way, but very important because it shines a light on the relationship between the rich world and the less rich world. and the need to balance that. I still think that the killing of 7 aid workers in Gaza and the ripple effect of that ranks first. But I do concede that the Times scoop on what we have to call Abbeygate, the spear phishing story in Westminster, pushes it up a notch and it changes the running order. So it's now in the middle of the running order. And I know that matters to you, Kat, where exactly in the ranking you come. I would have to say that I depart from your judgment on this. I think you're very generous to the Tories and concerned, as someone has to be, about the institution of Westminster. But my response to the story when I first read the William Ragg quotes was immediately party specific. I was immediately reminded of Tory sleaze in the mid-90s and the end of that era and the start of New Labour, and couldn't help but see this through the lens of how I imagine it is perceived in Number 10 as they struggle to get any traction with any policy and find any means of narrowing the polling gap with Labour. I take your point that there are issues, serious questions to be raised about whether MPs should be trained in how to comport themselves when sent spearfishing emails from apparently scantily clad men and women. But overwhelmingly, I'm struck by the fact that their vulnerability to these provocations means what we're getting into Parliament is a bunch of delayed adolescents, especially at the end of this long period dominated by one party who, for years now, have been scraping the barrel and handing us B-team ministers, B-team senior MPs, and B-team whips. And I have no doubt that William Ragg, poor fellow, who I quite see I can see the distinction between being a sex pest and a victim of blackmail, but I think he will go down in history as the last in a long line of caricatures of responsible politicians. I mean the very opposite, who finally did for the Conservatives at the end of this long and largely misbegotten political era. So with that, the running order has changed. The elephants in Botswana are an amuse-bouche. The scandal of Abbeygate moves up to second position, and Gaza, unfortunately but obviously, remains top of the running order. So that's it for this interesting episode of the News Meeting. If you think there's a story we missed, you can email us on newsmeeting@tortoisemedia.com. Thank you, Kat, for pitching not once but twice, and thank you to Jess and Jeevan. We'll be back with another episode on Monday. In the meantime, have a lovely weekend.
Tortoise. Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organisation, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimise the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com.
I'm David Baddiel. I'm a writer and a comedian and a Jew.
I'm Saeeda Varsi. I'm a businesswoman and a politician and a Muslim. Jews and Muslims always seem to be in the news or on the news. Lots of people talk about us, and this is us talking about ourselves. The kind of things that people say don't touch, yeah. We are going to go there.
I mean, I think Jews and Muslims are talking about these things, but I think they're not talking about them together because they're worried that if they do, sparks might fly. A Muslim and a Jew go there.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.